Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwindinger and Matthew Keener.
We're here to talk about some recent headlines and provide some insight and analysis and practical application that you can take into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Yeah, if you believe we are actually employed.
50-50.
All right, so our first headline that we're going to talk about is Top Insurer CNA disconnects systems after cyber attack. And we got this from CyberScoop, and there's actually some bits of information that we pulled off some other sites, including CNA's website itself, assets.kpmg, because apparently KPMG has enough money that they can just throw at the domain folks and have their own domain. It's kind of fancy. And woodrooflawyer.com, which I guess is a cyber lawyer liability company or another insurance provider.
Another insurance company. They had some interesting things to say about cyber insurance in general.
Right. So the gist of this article is that CNA, who provides cyber insurance as well as other types of insurance, was hit with a cyber attack that prompted them to disconnect their systems from its network. So the attack caused a network disruption that impacted certain CNA systems, including corporate email. These are quotes from their actual page that they have posted on their site. And out of an abundance of caution, we have disconnected our systems from our network, which continue to function.
That's interesting. What type of attack would you disconnect your systems from the network? I mean, ransomware is the obvious one, but that would mean they don't function anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about the context, because what are they saying is continuing to function? The compromised systems? The network overall? I don't know. It's one of those lawyers, you know, it's part of that lawyer speak that they throw up on there that sometimes is more confusing than clarifying. But on their page, they say, oh, we will update customers if we found that they've been impacted. So they haven't even finished their analysis yet. So a lot of this is really vague in general, or what they have on their site is really vague in general, just to indicate, yeah, there's a problem and we're working on it. So, but the CNA company is one of the top 15 property and casualty insurers and among the top 12 for cyber insurance overall. So this event apparently happened on March 21st, and they're currently working with third-party experts and have informed law enforcement about the incident. So they are still trying to figure out exactly what happened. But one of the interesting things on there that they mentioned that it impacted corporate email, but if you go to their page, they ask people to email them, which is kind of weird. So I'm not sure exactly what the impact email was, if they're saying, oh, well, we can't contact you, or you can't contact us via the normal channel if you need to use these specific email addresses, and yet say that email has been impacted. So it's a very confusing statement.
I just checked their MX records. They're using Proofpoint for their, but that's not an actual mail server. That's just mail
protection. It's just a relay.
Yeah.
Really?
I was hoping to see if they're using Office 365 or something locally hosted, but they don't have it publicly listed.
Well, if you look at the who is for their domain, they appear to be using Google Cloud.
Is that for their current domain though? Because I imagine one of the things they probably, and we talk about this a little bit later, maybe, but like having a backup website that you can flip your DNS server to that's completely separate from your infrastructure in case something happens to it might be an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, you just change the DNS record. But in the who is, it said that record had not been updated since last November. So I don't think they changed where that was pointing to. So if they're using, maybe it could be that they're just using Google Cloud for their website, but if the website was not affected, I'm not sure why they took down the website and just have this posting, which indicates that they're undergoing some challenges right now.
Yeah.
So the communications there, and I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago in the last, when we were talking about news last time, is that communications in a event are really important to be clear, concise, and uniform to ensure that the stakeholders, whether they be customers, vendors, regulators, etc., are have some level of confidence that you know what you're doing in handling the problem. Now, according to the article, one of the chief concerns, according to Coalition CEO Joshua Mata, and his company does cyber risk, provides cyber risk management tools and cyber insurance, is that the threat actors may be aware of companies that have applied for insurance and those that have purchased it, as well as what coverage they have for extortion or ransomware, as well as the limits and deductibles on those policies. And I can see how some of that, so I guess we kind of get into this about, you know, why does this even matter now? So I think what he's talking about is not quite as far down the rabbit hole as I went with it. So, because if, assuming that CNA doesn't just give a policy or issue a policy to customers without evaluating their organization, then they have done some kind of determination in order to determine the risk level, which is going to give them an idea about how much they're going to charge this company, how high those deductibles are going to be, whether they're going to give them insurance at all. And I think that in order to have they're going to have that information on their site or in their systems. So not only do you understand the policy details about the CNA customers, you may have an idea about their weaknesses and the challenges they're having or where they're falling down at as far as their overall cybersecurity stance or posture.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not paying attention over here. I've been diving into PassiveTotal. It does look like they switched their infrastructure on the 22nd of March. So that's interesting. It's not really a surprise.
What, they switched it to Google?
Yep. They went from, they were hosting it on Continental Casualty Company was the organization that owned the ASN. They actually own their own NetBlock.
Okay. So now that makes sense that why they have that up on Google. That was something that they could quickly transition to.
Yeah. They kept their domain registration. They just switched where it was going to, and probably bought some cheap space on Google and threw up that page.
Yeah. And actually, I assume that you could probably just do that with a credit card. So yeah. You wouldn't necessarily have to have something pre-staged in order to be prepared for that kind of switch then. Because they were able to get it done in a day or less than a day.
Yeah, it shouldn't be too transition. Bad. Shouldn't be too bad to do that. But it'd be nice to have that kind of pre-planned. To right. kind of know ahead of time, because that definitely takes away from effort, time and effort you should be putting into incident response to kind of focus on how are we going to get back in touch with our customers.
Right. It takes the thinking out of the response.
Yep.
It's kind of like any kind of DR situation or even physical altercation. If you've done, you know, martial arts training or whatever, and just respond or react. I interviewed one time with a company and I was asking them about their DR plan. And they were like, oh, well, we think we would do this. We would think we would do that. And I was like, well, you obviously have some kind of DR plan that you've already contemplated. You just need to write that down.
Yeah.
You know, so when it comes to it, you guys aren't going to be basically fielding opinions from these different people about, well, I think we should do it this way. We should do it that way. You actually have it written down on paper. Yeah. So as I was mentioning a minute ago, that if CNA is doing assessments of the organizations that they're insuring, this is something you should consider when you're dealing with your own cyber insurance company. You know, what have you told them about your preparedness? Did they do an assessment or a pen test, or did you provide them a copy of one as part of the negotiations to determine what kind of policy you're going to have? Is there a requirement for you to send them regular reports about how well your organization is doing, regular vulnerability assessment reports, regular pen test reports?
You know, that actually, that's a question from me. Like, I don't know how cyber insurance operates. If they just do a single point in time assessment, like your protections can drift over time, you know, both in negative and positive ways. you know, you don't maintain your inventory, you're not, you know, updating your security software, you're not getting your patches out there. But on the other hand, you could be improving your security significantly, which should drive down your rates. I wonder what kind of update process they have.
Well, it could be that they're doing it based on your contract. So if you have an annual contract, maybe every year at renewal, they're like, okay, well, we got to do a reassessment in order to, you know, re-sign the contract or issue a new contract.
Yeah, they definitely should, because they don't do that for my own insurance. Like, although I guess for homes, not much changes.
Well, the thing with that type of insurance, though, if you were to have home insurance, right? They're going to issue the policy and everything like that. But if you go back and you install a security system, mm-hmm. you can go back to your insurance company and say, hey, I've installed this, provide evidence, and they can lower your deductible or lower your rate based on the fact that you have that.
But the impetus has to come from you. You right. have to go to yes. them and say, so it's a push system, not a pull system.
Right. I think different insurance companies are probably going to do this differently, because I imagine that at some point, you know, vehicle insurance companies will give you a discount if you put a black box in your car.
Yeah, Allstate does that. I just had a discussion with someone from Allstate the other day, and they pointed out that they were the first company that did that.
Yay.
They're not required yet, though. Yet. I'm sure they will be in the future.
Well, maybe. They've been touting that for quite some time. But what I'm thinking is that maybe they're going to want to start putting black boxes on people's networks, much like something they would in the car, and say, hey, if you do this, then we'll give you a discount.
Yeah, especially with some of that breach and attack simulation tools out there.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
where they don't even, they just tell you, you have to, like, they might or might not put their own black box, but yeah, they could tell you, you have to put this simulation tool in, you have to set it up this way, and then you've got to feed us your results.
Right.
Or like maybe the dashboards or something, maybe not all the results, but because there'll probably be some, you know, private issues and privacy issues and revealing too much information, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Because I imagine right now, I mean, cyber insurance is still pretty new. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that some of the smaller insurers are probably just saying, well, give us your SOC 2 and, you know, we will make an assessment based on that or something along those lines, standard cyber reports to mm-hmm. determine what that level is going to be at. But, you know, the more mature it gets, the better they become at risk modeling for this business, the more data elements or whatever they're going to start collecting in order to make those determinations.
Yeah, that's where this is going to get really valuable, is in 5 or 10 or 15 years when they have enough of a history of data to start predicting who's going to be popped. And you'll see that in the rates. Or yeah, we'll give you insurance, but we're going to charge you $1 million a year. And you're like, wait a second, the average cost of an incident is like $2 million. I'm going to be popped within the next 2 years.
Yeah, I think a lot of these cyber insurance companies that have been providing cyber insurance to local municipalities that have been hit really hard with ransomware over the last year are probably really rethinking
how
they're doing this.
Yeah. It'd be a little unpleasant.
I would imagine so. I mean, I'd just be curious to see what kind of conversations those guys are really having about this whole ransomware and cyber insurance stuff. That's really taken off relatively recently. You know, we're talking about cyber insurance being new, but cyber insurance paying out for this ransomware stuff is even newer than that. There are probably some really interesting conversations that they're having internally about how they're going to do this going forward. Mm-hmm. But some of the other things that you should consider about this situation is that, you know, they may have gotten what we just talked about. So if the attackers get these reports, then they're going to have a list of who's insured, possibly their own weaknesses of that company. And then they may be able to take that information to pivot to the customers from the insurer to know who makes the most sense to attack because they've got something that you can exploit. You know they're insured, you know what their deductible is, So you have a high, basically a high fidelity indicator that, hey, if we hit these guys, we ransomware them, they're going to pay.
I mean, if you extend that into a future incident where they have some sort of black box with, you know, one of those breach and attack simulations, you're practically giving them a roadmap on how to get in. That would be interesting. I wonder if there would be lawsuits at that point.
Well, depending on what that black box is, you know, if they throw, you know, an Attack IQ or some other vendor on there, then, you know, that's an appliance. But if they're doing some kind of, hey, we're going to throw this Nessus scanner on your network, and we're going to run periodic scans, and we're going to take that data.
Yeah, that's a little different.
Yeah, because if they pivot from that insurance company into that Nessus scanner, then you're in real trouble. Right?
I think they would almost certainly do it as a third party at that point, though. Like, it would not, I don't think they would directly put their own operated boxes. Like, I think they would do it as a third party, or you have to have a piece of this type of technology, and you have to like forward us reports rather than saying we're going to put our own systems in your network, because I think that'd be a huge liability.
Yeah, probably. But it also could depend on what their IT department is, or what their own cybersecurity folks want, because you know how cybersecurity engineers are like, we can build it ourselves and it'll be awesome.
You're not wrong.
You know, you end up with that kind of thing, you're like, I don't know, is it really going to be that awesome? You know, have you thought about maintaining it and all that? So
that's just the part that nobody ever thinks about, right? People just want to build it. Nobody wants to maintain it. I mean, maintenance and operations is terrible. Nobody wants to do that.
Well, no, I mean, whenever you go into budget, it's always like, okay, how much does the software cost? They don't go into saying, okay, well, yeah, sure, it costs $500,000, but really the expense is much larger than that, because you have to have 40% of an employee's time to maintain it. You have to buy this hardware, you have to buy this dedicated storage, et cetera, et cetera. So no one, at least no place I've really been, talks about real total cost of ownership when they're buying an application. But I guess we've kind of gotten off track here a bit.
I guess.
But something else I was thinking about going through this article is, so you got a cyber insurance company, they're assessing risk of other companies. Are they assessing themselves against the same criteria, saying, oh, if we were to insure ourselves, what would we say about our posture? Yeah. You know, are they eating their own dog food? I think that would be an interesting thing to know. I'm not saying we ever will, but it just made me curious about if they're taking their own, and this could actually even help themselves improve those models. If they're taking those things and modeling them against themselves and saying, oh, well, if we make these changes, then that reduces our risk, so we can change our offerings to our customers. So,
you know, it's funny you mentioned that, because that's also something related to, that I think insurance companies are going to have some super valuable information on. And that is, which security technologies and which detection methods are the best? Because they're going to be able to take, and again, we discussed this a little bit beforehand, because they're not going to share this information, but if we could somehow get all of the information from all the insurance companies on what systems everybody had and what their postures were and what their policies were, and then how which of them got compromised, I think you could be able to actually pull out best practices from that. Like, if you had this policy, or if you were using, you know, this vendor, you were 30% less likely. And I get that it's never that simple. There's also the configuration. There's also the coverage. There's, did you get it installed on every system versus, you know, you forgot that one RDP facing system with the 4-letter password. But right, I think it'd be really interesting. I think they'd have a lot of information on like what is actually best in security.
Yeah, I mean, everything that you're talking about are these data elements that they should be throwing into their risk models if they're running on those huge antiquated mainframes in their basements.
Yeah, the problem is that we're never going to see them. They're going to have this to themselves. And the only way we'll ever find out is if we could ever like directly compare quotes. We'd be like, hey, you know, the CNA quoted us 50,000, and then the next person, oh, they only quoted us 40,000 this year. Well, yeah. And then again, trying to compare apples to oranges is tough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if it could be another profit generating aspect for them, though, to take that data and then spin it off to a security consulting company or something like that.
Yeah.
and say, oh, well, you guys go out and start consulting with these organizations about how to get them better. And oh, and by the way, once you pitch that they should be insured by us.
Yeah. And then we'll give them better rates if they follow your instructions too.
Right.
It's interesting.
The free market at work.
That would be interesting.
And as we were mentioning before, also that the changes of the website and everything, consider, you know, preparing for an incident before it happens. You know, are your backups ready? How do you know how to communicate to your customers if your website's down or your main communication channel is down? Are you doing tabletop exercises in this type of event?
Yeah, that's what we were discussing before. While you're in the middle of, you know, your CISO and your CIO are knees deep and trying to respond to this major event and the systems are shut down, they're trying to, you know, get things back up and running. And then the lawyers and the comms team are out their back going, we need to talk to our customers. We need to talk to our customers. You know, none of our mail is working. That is not a distraction you want at that time.
Right. Actually, talking about having a enterprise incident response and then having your cybersecurity be a subset of that. Keep them separate, but that, you know, a security incident is just a type of enterprise incident that impacts the organization, you know, differently.
Yeah. I'm sorry. And what I meant was, like, you don't put them on the same bridge.
Oh, right.
You keep, yeah, you've got the technical people working on the technical problem, and then you've got a separate group of people working on the response from the corporation. The, you know, how do we announce this? What's our press release look like? What's our legal liability will look like? All that stuff.
Right. Communication path, especially. Mm. So the bottom line for this, you know, what should you do about it is make sure you treat your insurance provider just like you would any other third party, you know, because they're going to know stuff about you that others aren't. So take that into consideration when you're working with them about how they're securing that data, not just trust that, oh, they're doing a great job. No, if they do an assessment of your organization prior to issuing the policy, you should probably really take that to heart and do the work if they point out shortcomings, because there's two main reasons to do that. One, they may give you a better rate if you can prove that you've actioned what they said you were falling down on. And two, you'll be ready should someone get that data and try to leverage that against you. We mentioned a moment ago about tabletops. So there are templates and stuff you can get through ISACs, and they're actually third party consulting companies that will run tabletops for you as well, so that you don't necessarily bias your tabletops by building them yourself.
Yeah, and it seems like it's pretty easy there to bring somebody in for a couple $1,000 to run a tabletop for you. And I mean, especially if you've never done it before and you have no idea what to do or how to do it, have them come in and demonstrate it for you. Tell them, you know, you want them to teach you how to do it. They come in, they run it for you, take good notes, and you can turn around and run it again. And, you know, 3 to 6 months yourself, use a template you found online. The hardware stuff doesn't have to exactly match your own. Don't have to spend a ton of time trying to make sure that it's exactly what you guys have. Although your IT people will probably complain. That's always something we heard. Well, our systems don't function exactly that way. Shut up. What if they did? You're missing the point.
Yeah. It's close enough for government work, right?
Yeah, I mean, the whole point is to discuss it and put it in mind and figure out what you're going to do ahead of time instead of at the time.
And not only that, it helps you identify what procedures or stuff you're lacking or things you need to address.
Yep, you'll get to that point in your tabletop where you're like, and all right, and what if this happened? What will we do? Or, you know, this just happened. What are you going to do about it? And everybody's going to stare at each other and they're going to be like, I don't know.
Right. And I've never thought of that.
You're finding that out ahead of time. Yeah. Right. Some of these things are easy enough to just, you know, you come into the office on Monday and you say, hey, backups. When was the last time we tested the backup? And if the answer was we confirmed it was working, you know, last week, like, oh, that's good. That's cool. And now you know.
Yeah. And maybe consider, you know, would those backups be affected by a ransomware? You know, are those going to be encrypted also?
Yeah.
But I think that about does it for that topic. Anything else you can think of, Matt, we should discuss for that one?
No, I think that's enough insurance for one day.
You never have too much insurance. Just ask them. They'll tell you. Next topic we're going to talk about is actually taken from two different articles, both on the exact same incident. So the first one is resentful employee deletes 1,200 Microsoft Office 365 accounts, gets prison. That's from Bleeping Computer. And then there's business beware of the vengeful IT contractor, and that's from Bitdefender. So what happened was in 2018, a contractor who'd been dismissed from the company and subsequently fired from the consulting company he was working for, used his credentials to log into that customer company and delete over 1,200 of 1,500 Office 365 accounts. And then he made the mistake of coming back to the US 2 years later, and they nabbed him at the airport. So a little bit of background on exactly what happened here. So this fellow was working for a consulting firm, and they hired him out to one of their customers to help them migrate to what was then Office 365. Now they call it Microsoft 365. And in January 2018, he was pulled from that contract because the customer said he was doing subpar work. And then in May, I guess the consulting company finally caught on to the fact that he was basically subpar overall and let him go. After which he then returned to India. And then in August of 2018, which is what, 7 months after he was originally let go from the contract, he quote unquote hacked into the customer organization and deleted those accounts. And apparently deleting all those accounts made it so the company could not communicate with its customers or vendors, and ended up costing them 2 days of downtime and over $500,000.
Weird. Weren't we just talking about something like this?
It does sound familiar. And in addition to those 2 days of downtime, they ended up dealing with problems from this deleting of those accounts for 3 months. And overall, long-lasting problems where employees couldn't get to their contacts. So if you're talking about a sales guy and he loses his contacts, that's a big deal. And some employees could not get to folders that they could access previously.
Man, I don't know. I can think of some sales guys I wish would lose my contacts.
Yeah, well, no. Usually that you don't end up being on the lucky side of that problem.
No.
But if you use Lotus Notes, those could go away at any time. Office 365, I'm sure it's a little bit, I'm sure that's better. You know, why does this matter that, you know, this company did this? What can we take away from this? So account management is hard, and it's even harder for dealing with contractors versus full-time employees. Even if you have an automated system to do identity access management, those are usually tied into HR systems, and a lot of HR systems don't necessarily have contractor information in there so that the identity system can action hires and removals. And sometimes HR is not involved at all in the acquisition of contractors. And because contractors are not treated like employees, it causes gaps in your process. You know, maybe they don't get a laptop, or maybe their account access is limited, or maybe they only get certain types of accounts. So because there's a difference there in how you handle employees, you may have the employee path down really well, but the contractors, because they deviate from that, you can't simply overlay that same process on a contractor onboarding or offboarding. And you should also consider limiting the access to SaaS solutions.
One of the benefits of SaaS solutions, they usually have better logging than default logging enabled on-prem.
Yeah, but do you get those logs into your SIM?
I guess that really depends, yeah. I was just thinking, one of the things I was thinking about here is the fact that it was Office 365. So those logs were probably what the default logging in Office 365 is pretty good. That made it really easy for them to go figure out exactly who deleted all the accounts. If it had been on-prem, especially if he deleted the logs after himself, it may have been a lot more difficult to figure out who specifically did it.
Well, if you're not doing, you know, log management, but that's going to a centralized logging facility also.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's hard to tell, but just from the sound of this, they're subpar HR work. I can make a guess. They're probably not doing much in terms of insider threat. And they only had 1500 people. Companies only have 1500 people usually don't have a robust security group.
Yeah, well, the security team is probably one guy in the IT department or a couple of guys in the IT department.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it depends on what they do though, because they may only have a small company, but their revenue may be such that they can hire an MSSP to do some of that work. And, you know, your mileage may vary there. Mm-hmm. But what you can do in order to hopefully prevent this kind of thing from happening to your organization is sit down with all the stakeholders and actually workflow out your employee and your contractor onboarding and offboarding process. You know, make sure you have HR there, IT, contracting and or procurement, people who are involved in bringing on that employee, getting them access, getting them the devices they need, et cetera. So go sit down with all those stakeholders, and it's probably gonna take you a couple hours to sit down and get everybody in the room and the workflows out, but it'll be well worth it to have that documented. Because once you have that documented, then you can ensure that if nothing else, you ensure that your hiring managers are trained on the process and understand the process and how they fit into it. You know, when you bring on an employee, you should do these things. When you offboard an employee, you should do these things. Same thing for contractors. And if you're lucky enough that your organization can afford to purchase an identity access management solution, then you could take that workflow and you could build it into that. Or if nothing else, you could build it into your ticketing system so that that workflow is in the ticketing system. So tasks are generated, you know, and if the hiring manager would go and say, hey, I want to hire a contractor, they go into the ticketing system and say, click on that ticket, submit it, and it already has the process, the workflow built out in that ticketing workflow.
Yeah, it seems like that's certainly easy enough to do, at least your manual checklists. Like even if you don't have the automation built in, especially for a smaller company, pretty much every ticketing system has the ability to insert, you know, like a manual checklist.
Right. Yeah. And also you can indicate, you know, who's responsible for each one of those checklist items. So if you build out your workflow with swim lanes on it, then that makes it even easier to ensure that gets translated into a process, whether it's manual or automated.
Yep. And that's some sort of what I'm looking for, accountability to it. So right, you can go back and figure out where it broke down if it fails as well.
Yeah, not necessarily to indicate blame, but you know, how you can improve that step.
But that'd help you at least figure out kind of what step did it break down? Why did it break down? You know, such and such is working on it. They were super busy. They had 50 tickets that day. Et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And something else this indicates is that, you know, when you, and this may not be exactly what happened in this instance, but when you know someone is going to depart the organization, you'd probably put some steps in there to say, all right, when someone submits their 2-week notice, you know, we're going to do something to increase our monitoring level over those individuals. Because you have people stockpiling, you know, talking about sales guys will take key information from the organization in order to help them make sales to those people that they built the relationship with at this organization, at their next organization.
That's the main reason to hire a sales guy away, right?
A lot of these, well, some people will consider that those types of pieces of information that they have theirs and not necessarily the organization's.
Right.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that they're malicious, but they may misunderstand the ownership of some data elements that they work with all the time.
I mean, I can understand. Like, even from my position, you know, I work on a policy or a procedure for, you know, weeks or months. And then if I leave, I don't get to take that with me. I can take the experience of doing it. And it'll definitely make it easier to do a second time. But
yeah, well, you can always do. Unfortunately, I don't have the reference for me, but I was working for one organization. They were seriously working on some insider threat stuff. And the insider threat guy was looking at case studies. And there was a Chinese fellow who was working for, I want to say it was IBM, as a programmer, where he would go to work and he would be programming at work. And then he would go home and he would basically recreate the programming he had done at work at home. Yep. So you could always do that.
Yeah, I guess that's technically still, yeah.
Because that's really hard to get to catch.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's ethical or anything, but, and I don't even know how the guy could do that because I could not recreate a sentence that I wrote at home that I'd written the day before.
Was he doing it? Was it an espionage thing or was he working two jobs?
I'm not sure. They caught him before they got out of the country because he printed it out on paper. And he got caught trying to smuggle it out of the country.
Interesting. Sounds like it was security related, though.
I mean, everybody would assume that anything to do with the Chinese is deals with the government over there, but I can't say for sure. This was related to me by the insider threat guy. I didn't read it, so that's why I don't have the reference for you. I can see if I can find it though.
No worries.
Excuse me. But what else you can do about it? We talked about having an identity access management system. So if you have one of those, that would obviously be ideal over a ticketing system or any manual process. So something like a core security that used to be Curion or SailPoint that can automate the processing of onboarding and offboarding so that it happens in an automatic fashion when you get rid of somebody or when they no longer work for the organization. You don't have to remember to go and do this step, that step, that step, etc.
It's interesting.
And some of those, I think I mentioned it before, that some of those systems, if they tie into the HR system and your contractors are not in the HR system, then they're going to get missed by that automated process. So whichever solution you implement, make sure that contractors are taking into consideration when you're deploying that or when you're implementing it or when you're integrating that. And of course, one of the things that also fell down here outside of removing the individual access is he accessed that organization who was in California, their Microsoft SaaS from India. Now, you should really limit access to SaaS solutions or any as a service solutions, if you can, by either, you know, region. You know, if all your employees are in the United States, there's no reason that your SaaS solution should be able to be accessed by someplace outside the country, or even if you're not having, and this is probably different because of COVID and everybody's working remote, you know, force access to that solution only from the corporate IP space and make sure you have MFA on all of those, and the MFA is part of the offboarding process where you disable their token or you take their physical token from them when they leave the organization. And depending on the SaaS solution, we were talking about logging a minute ago. So Microsoft in M365 has really good logging and you can get that data into your SIM, but a lot of SaaS solutions are not really good with getting that log data. So you can monitor that and look for this kind of activity. So make sure you engage with those providers when you are, well, it may be too late, but if you are considering a SaaS provider, make sure you talk to them about what logs they can provide you. Do they tell you who logged in, when they logged in, where they logged in from, and what access they took while they're in there? Because in a SaaS solution, you are still responsible for user access and the data that's in that SaaS solution. That's not on the vendor. So you have to protect yourself in those situations.
Yeah, and you're definitely going to want to do that for the SaaS ones, especially because you will find out very quickly that a lot of them will not keep those logs potentially, or the logs will have to be requested specially. You may not have access to them. Like you said already, a lot of them will not be able to deliver it to your SIM, but sometimes it'll be enough just knowing that they have them. And also you'll want to know their retention period. Do they keep it for a couple of days? Do they keep it for 30 days, especially for some of these insider threat ones, depending on how destructive they are and how sneaky they are, you may not find out about it for days, weeks, or months.
Yeah, and make sure when you're talking to them about that, ask them about your level of access to those logs. Because they may say, oh yeah, we got it. But if they're the only ones looking at it, they're not looking at it.
No, they're not.
Because they're not responsible for it. So you have to make sure that you understand, you know, if they have it, are you going to be able to get access to it? Whether that's preferably through log shipping to your SIM or something like that, or if you have to log in on a regular basis and check something or something along those lines. All right. Any other suggestions, Matt?
No, just that we mostly tend to focus on external, even with all the talk lately about internal threat and how important it is that you watch your internal users. In my experience, we still are excessively focused on external users, or well, external attackers, external unauthorized users, and just constantly focused on what they might do to us. And we don't spend nearly enough time looking at the people that are already have access to our network.
It's kind of funny when you think about it though, because when an attacker gets on your network, usually they are using one of your accounts. Yeah. So they look just like they're an insider.
Yep. They're using PowerShell. They're using, you know, RDP. They're using the same tools your own people are using to go back and forth. So yeah. So by not looking for insiders, you're basically not looking for attackers once they've compromised an account.
I feel like it ought to have one of those more, you know, stickers on that.
Go find a sound effect if someone's got the time. Add it in there.
All right, well, I think that does it for this article then, and this episode, actually.
What?
All right, yes, I guess. All good things must come to an end.
All right. Well, I guess that's all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.